Well, as I've listened to the talks that have gone on at the meeting so far, looked at the SIGs, for example, listened to the speakers, I think that we're all coming to the same awareness of the challenges that we face and some sense that we need to do a better job, certainly, of responding to the challenges. I'm reminded of what the Secretary of DPW in our state said some years ago, that the challenge of dealing with autism is that you have to invent new tires and change the tires on a car while the car is still going 75 miles an hour. And so that's sort of what's happening in research, except it's so much more complex than that, as you can tell from the few talks that we've already heard. There's a lot of discovery, invention, so to speak, going on in many different parts or components of autism. And the issue is, how do we get that to the point where it improves practice? And the other analogy that I was sort of thinking about is that as we watch these remarkable events occurring in scientific discovery in autism, it reminds me of standing on the bluff and seeing the herd of horses that are running through the valley below, and you can see the pathway that where they've come from, but where the herd is, there's just a whole lot of dust. So you can't actually see what's going on that well at the leading edge. And then you look ahead and there's many exits from that valley. And you don't know what one they're going to choose or what factors are going to influence that. And that may sound like, why are we talking about that? But I think it comes back to, what are our realistic expectations for what science and discovery are going to look like? And how do we begin to leverage what we've learned to improve the lives of people today? And of course, we're dealing with a massive amount of information and discovery that is an ongoing process. Discovery is not a destination, it is a process. Or if it's a destination, it's sometime in the future. So with that in mind, I had, you know, some basic comments that reflect what we've all thinking about and what we've heard in one way or another. I think the hope that we all have is that someday in the future we'll have Star Trek, where we have truly individualized diagnosis and treatment, and we have new treatments that will substantially modify the course of any disorder, including autism, and change outcome. We want that assessment process, so to speak, to be rapid, and that means quick, hopefully a day or less, instead of you could go weeks and still not complete all the assessments that we could do today. We'd like it to be highly accurate. We want it to be thorough because we want it to account for all the features of the disorder, not just the major features, but all of the so-called associated features and complications. We want it to account, this Star Trek method, to account for the variability across domains, but also at all pathophysiologic levels. So we want genetics and epigenetics all the way to behavior. We'd like it to predict trajectory and accurately predict a response to treatment. And along the way, of course, we hope all this research identifies mechanisms that will be targeted for new interventions of various kinds and will have substantially improved outcomes. And of course, we'd like to do this rapid diagnosis, so to speak, or assessment of the status of the individual in a way that over time, as the biology and behavior evolves, that we can see change, see response to treatment, and make course adjustments. So to me, that's sort of the Star Trek of the future. And when I listen to our first talks of the day and throughout the day, I think there is proof of concept, clearly, that we will achieve that. But it's not yet. But we will get there. So I think that's really the hope, is it is feasible that someday we will arrive there. As Bernie Devlin said this morning, his hope is that in the very near future, there'll be a much better understanding of the genetics. He also pointed out that advances are going to be exponential. Whenever advances are based on math, your improvements are going to be exponential. So we're hitting a period of time when technology is largely mathematically based. And so the rate of progress can accelerate, and that's the expectation as well. Now, the problem is that what do you do in the meantime? Although many of us that have been around for a long time know that things are much better today for families than they were 20 or 30 years ago, they're still not what a family would consider very good. We've got enormous gaps. But we've also suffered tremendously from the hype, the distortion, the guesses that have been made. And some of the speakers have reviewed a number of instances where we've had those leaps. And I think we need a culture change at all levels so that the pressure to tell the final story, the great story that makes wonderful sense, backs off so that we see the findings for what do they mean in the present context? What question, perhaps, or aspect of the question have we answered, but what's the next question that we should be considering, and how does that all come together? But right now, whether you're in a university and you have a job and or people who are reviewing papers or grants, they want to know that whatever you're doing is the home run ball. And that's a distortion, distorting force on everything. And of course, I think also for families, they also want this to make sense, and they want it to make sense right now. And everybody wants it to be simple, but it's not going to be simple. Anybody that attends this meeting knows the more we learn, the more complex it gets. And are we really so surprised that the brain and brain development are incredibly complex in ways we cannot yet imagine? And then, of course, there's the press. It was wonderful to see that we had a session, IES, yesterday on how to meet the press, so to speak. But it's really a culture, again, that I think science and families are going to need to challenge. Because every reporter comes up and says, tell me what autism is in two or three sentences. And you really cannot do that. You can't. But that's what they want. They want the 30 to 60 seconds. And that, of course, forces them into, give me a bottom line that's flashy and dramatic, because your story is going to last 60 seconds if you're lucky. But that is a huge disservice to everybody. And then, of course, we have a variety of circulating myths that spring up as, the anecdotal events or whatever, and because of the internet, they achieve a life of their own. But perhaps, as I alluded to, the biggest myth is that the explanation for what causes autism and therefore what might be a successful treatment, the biggest myth is that the answer is simple. And as I've said, the brain's not simple, the genome's not simple, the development, the environment, all aspects of the environment, there's nothing simple about that. And so the answer won't be simple. And another concern I think we all share is that families and individuals need treatment now, and we're not translating the enormous progress that has been made in research into advances in the community, and if it happens, it's spotty. Instead, what happens, of course, is we all read about the new treatments springing up everywhere that are often rather costly, and parents are frightened by, if you don't do it now, you'll lose your chance. And they can't afford, they feel like they can't afford not to enroll in a variety of things. But the other part is there can be side effects. And of course, it's your time and your child's time, and that time will not come again. And you want to know that your effort and your child's effort were not for nothing, because you could have had fun. For not that intervention can't be fun, but there are other things that people could do. So at any rate, what are the challenges? One of them, in listening about what's happening with DSM-5, is that we consider what is the diagnostic precision of the versions of DSM criteria that we've had. In universities and trials, it might be 0.7 to 0.8, but in the community, it's more like 0.3 to 0.4, which is a real challenge. The other thing, of course, is we encounter with autism a highly complex, highly variable, low prevalence disorder. So is your 0.3 to 0.4, maybe it's even lower than that because of all of that. How many clinicians that families rely on see enough cases that they have a good grasp of the complexity and the variability of this disorder? Response to treatments is highly variable and unpredictable, which is really unfortunate. They're time intensive, often costly, and you have no idea in advance if your child is going to respond. And that reminds me, of course, that intervention is a lifetime. We often talk about intervention as though it's only early or it's not intervention, and that needs to change. The brain is always changing, and of course, because of what we know about plasticity, there are always opportunities for intervention. We need to find them and get them into practice. Certainly, we're looking forward to a pharmacology in which we will actually have drugs that change or restore brain development. But at the moment, we're using adjunctive medications. As many of you know, it's not uncommon for these individuals who are having trouble to end up on 5 or 6 medications, most of which are probably not effective. And I don't even know how they walk under such a load. My personal peeve is that environmental stressors and therefore environmental engineering is grossly unappreciated and probably ought to be used much more than medications are used. And then few of the community interventions that parents must rely on have an evidence base. And then there's large gaps in intervention. Now, I think that as I go through these things, that you can probably add considerably to every slide, and we need to ultimately have that dialogue. It's sort of the quick overview. Now, what are the nominees for Star Trek? And the previous speakers have done an excellent job of talking about subtypes, which has been around as a topic since autism has been around. And they first were behavioral and unidimensional, and of course now we're appreciating that it's a systems problem and it's multiple levels of pathophysiology. We've moved on to looking for endophenotypes, which might be closer to the originating events, but that's in its infancy. And we have many aspects of technology that are being applied to characterize autism. So all of this highlights the potential, but also the complexity, and that we have a long ways to go. But again, I'd say they document the feasibility, but we have to look at the time frame. Now, what's helping us move forward is that we have such a better understanding of impaired abilities and enhanced or intact abilities in autism than 10 years ago, 20, 30 years ago. So I think that's very helpful. We just haven't disseminated that understanding very far. The next thing is DSM, as you know, has changed from the Roman numerals to more like a software package. So the next one is going to be DSM 5.0, indicating that from the beginning they anticipate this to be a living document that's going to grow as the understanding grows. The other thing is, though, it's being created on a platform that will allow the clinician and the family, the individual, to pull in all relevant information, which I think has wonderful potential. If you're the clinician or you're the individual or parent, to be able to go to DSM and within five clicks or so, see what each manifestation looks like in very different individuals will hopefully start to improve our reliability and validity of diagnosis. And then to be able to pull in the literature in all varieties. So a lot of potential, take time to achieve it, but a lot of that information exists. And I think that if we look at what Autism Speaks and the Safari websites have done for all of science and also for the community in centralizing knowledge, but also in a way that's vetted. So that if a family or a researcher wants to read about in advance, they can go to one of these websites and know that they've carefully examined the report and you're getting an educated opinion, which we all know is not true about websites. So I think these two tools are examples of advances that we can make. Now, as I've said, the problem is we've got a lot of knowledge. We haven't pulled it together. We haven't made it available very widely, not to mention underdeveloped countries or rural areas, and we haven't translated that knowledge to practice. So we have to work on those. We still need to work considerably on figuring out, sort of like perhaps with another State of the Science conference, where we look at what do we know so far about diagnosis that we could feel comfortable disseminating worldwide so that at least everybody can function and operate on a common foundation of solid findings, so that it's not idiosyncratic, and so that parents aren't going from one assessment to another and getting different diagnoses for the same child that may be different ways of framing the child's issues but are not very helpful. The parent feels like they've just had four different diagnoses and they don't know what to believe, and their confidence, of course, falls. And we need the centralized database to be age and ability specific, so that no matter what your child's age and ability, you can go in and look at a good sampling of the evidence. And there need to be tracks that are specialized so that they're relevant to parents and teachers and pediatricians and neurologists, physical therapists, occupational therapists. And the other thing that I think we lack is that for families and individuals, we need some kind of standardized format and method for them to store the relevant information across the individual's lifespan. Anybody dealing with adults realizes that you can't even find the records from early childhood anymore. And so we need to be able to pull it all together in some format and store it so that it's readily accessible. And I'm sure that many of you can add to these lists. But I think that becomes our challenge. And it is not a challenge, oh, let's think about it, or abstract, a challenge as in a mandate to do something, to create progress that impacts every community. Because not everybody has a highly experienced autism person or even one that's up to date on everything. So those are really just the summary comments that I had, summary thoughts. I'm sure you all have more, but each of you needs to be part of the mandates that we've all talked about and that we all recognize. Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy. Don't go away too fast if you want to keep participating. We have 15 minutes. I'd ask all the speakers to come back up on the stage for a little panel for those that want to get into this more. I would hope that this has engendered even more questions or broader issues that we could possibly address. Can I just ask, they're coming up, I mean, how many would identify them on that prism, you know, on that tetrahedron, as far as scientist, clinician, parent, individual, media? I mean, how would generally say scientist? How many would, I'm sort of guessing, yeah. Okay, we got a fraction there. What about clinicians? Yeah, a little bit stronger fraction. What about advocate, parent, community representative? Great. And what about the media? Anybody going to identify themselves as media? All right. Thank you. So I'm going to open up the panel to any and all questions. Please state your name and where you're from, and let's get started. Or there we go.
David Eaton, Seattle Children's Autism Center. Dr. Minshew, you mentioned environmental engineering, and I wonder if you could elaborate on that a little bit and just what some ideas of that, what that might look like.
It's a term that I happen to like. It's empowering, but what I really mean about it is that it's how do we look around the world in which an individual with autism lives and identify the things that are very stressful and challenging to them, and how do we both give them, support them to have more adaptive strategies to cope with their challenges, but also to get people that they're interacting with, their environments that they're in, to make some relatively simple changes that can make a tremendous difference. What I, and I'm sure everybody else sees, is the person with autism that displays the what we call undesirable behavior, which can be anything from screaming to hitting to lots of verbal to throwing themselves on the floor. And then they may find themselves in an emergency room, and yet again another medication being added or increased, sent back, and everybody says, oh, that worked, that helped, and the cycle keeps going. And in actuality, the medicine didn't do anything. And if they really looked at it, what is really so helpful, and it used to be more true when they'd be admitted to the hospital, is you got them out of a chaotic setting that was very stressful to them. What was chaotic for them is probably chaotic too. And you get them into a structured, highly predictable setting where there's rules that they follow, but rules that everybody else follows, and they have protection. So unlike people with schizophrenia, where the antipsychotics are very specific in efficacy, they don't have that same purpose in autism, and you could often achieve the same calming results by doing just those things. But it's very hard to get people to realize that. I mean, I was at a place that served adults with out autism with IQ scores under 60, and one woman came up to me and said, "You're my best friend," and put her arm around me. And her caseworker said that was inappropriate behavior. You can't say that. And I'm always reminded that what was she trying to communicate? And how do we give her words or ways to express that? And how do we tell her that? Because to say to her, that was inappropriate, I'm sure she had no clue because she keeps doing it. And it was kind of funny. One of her peers said, oh, stop that. You know? but we often, something as simple as that, and I remember hearing Timbal Grandin say that some of the most wonderful aspects of what her mother did was instead of telling her what she did wrong, like stop that or don't do that, was her mother said what she should do. So if she was reaching across her sister to get the salt at the table, her mother would just say, Temple, ask your sister to pass the salt. So there was no, Temple, don't do that. No, the negativity was gone, the criticism and all the sarcasm that's in the voice, usually when you get frustrated that it's repeated behavior. But so that's really what I mean. And I think we could do an awful lot by looking at environment issues, and that includes how the other human beings interact with that person. And it could be the composition of the home, because there's some people, adults with autism, that are, of course, if you put them around other people with mental illnesses, it's so chaotic. It's too stressful for them. And yet the mental health care providers don't get the idea that that is their disability, dealing with the social contact, the change, the whatnot.
More questions?
Excellent panel. And my question is, how genetic testing is impacting current medical practice as it is recommended in many places?
To the panel. Janet, maybe? I don't know who could address that.
So I assume you're being thinking about autism. And as some of the other speakers mentioned, there are, you know, just hundreds of genes that play a small role in autism, and any gene that's associated with autism is not 100% associated with it. So I think, you know, at the present time, other than, you know, continuing to rule out Fragile X syndrome and major chromosome abnormalities and all of that, and just a lot of the parents like to know, you know, do their children have like some CNV abnormality, but at the present time it has no impact on treatment other than possibly for Fragile X.
More questions, please.
I'm from the Netherlands. And I'm a bit deaf because of the plane, but anyway, I'll try. Thank you all, and especially Professor Mincho for her helicopter view, and very inspiring. My question is to Dr. David Tsikos, is that there? And it's inspired by my background, I suppose. I wondered if you try to understand patterns by throwing all data from different patients in one data bin. If that leads to something, like if you try to understand the flood in Western Europe in 1953 with the floods in Bangladesh, you can't make sense of it by throwing in all the data from the different floods, because they have quite a different configuration and background.
Yeah, I think it's a good point, but number one, one hopes that what you're going after is some commonality between autism spectrum disorders and not what is different in each case. And this would be the first thing that you'd be able to find if you pull data. But if truly the disorder is so heterogeneous that each subpopulation has different characteristics, then there are other methods that can allow you to do that. Definitely not classification by itself, but you can have joint classification clustering methods that look at subtypes of the disorder, or more precise imaging phenotypes for given subpopulations. Certainly, if you're after a phenomenon that changes from one person to another, you cannot possibly hope for any predictive value. What you hope for is to find some commonalities.
I had a question for the panel. Just putting some of these questions and the talks together, you wonder, you know, what are the families and communities truly getting out of this? Certainly research is getting a lot out of it. Grant money, building your own labs, publications, the media is getting a lot out of it. And then it comes down to, you know, the subject burden of all these probings and pushings and, you know, a lot of time that they donate freely. It's probably been done before, but sort of a trade in kind, you know, maybe is there some way that you can give back or have it built into what they are giving that you give to the family, to the community somehow? I'm sure that's being done, but maybe that could be formalized in some way.
So in our study, of course, we have families who already have one affected child, in some cases more than one. And these are pretty anxious parents who are just waiting for the other shoe to drop with their baby. So I think we provide some comfort in doing a very thorough developmental evaluation over the first 3 years of life. So they're getting some feedback. They can get referrals. We can get them into early intervention. So at that level, we're providing, I think, care to some of these families. As the speaker pointed out, it's a problem in our study, but, you know, ethically, I don't see a way around it. The other thing I think is that it is making its way around the Boston community that parents who have already have one affected child need to be mindful of the risks of subsequent children. You know, we have one family the baby had four affected SIBs and now the baby is on the spectrum. And, you know, this is a pretty rocky family, and so we can also provide offline, not part of the research protocol, but support for these families by making appropriate referrals.
Thanks, Chuck. I think this will have to be the last question, please.
I'm sorry, I was called out by a phone call, so I just came back. I just want to make add on to what Dr. Minshew said. I am Max Wisnitzer from Cleveland. I have the frequent opportunity to interact with the media about questions regarding autism. And one of my pet peeves is news releases from the medical centers and universities that extol the study as God's gift to mankind. And the researchers are quoted as affirming that statement. And that includes some of the, I wager there are people here at this meeting who have actually been quoted in their press releases as doing that. We have to be very careful. Because then the media picks up on that. And luckily, for those of you who do not know, the media has become much more savvy about autism compared to the early days. They frequently will ask a small group of individuals to comment about the applicability and the wonderfulness, if you want to call it that way, of studies that are published and their applicability as it pertains to what our first speaker said. And I think if we disseminated out to the media what the first speaker said about the level at which these studies are now being done, it would be a big service in terms of allowing the public to be adequately and appropriately informed about the research. Because autism is sexy. Excuse me for saying that. And all the media focuses on is the autism, even if the studies talk about three other conditions.
Very, 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 very good point. We'll all know, we don't really need the media, you know, in one way to really know what's going on through the communities, through the ground-based networks. We can really know. I think the media has a very good service. We don't want to knock it completely, but at all, really, we don't want to knock it that much because there's really good reporters out there. I think we've all come across some excellent science reporters. I think with this, we'll close the session. Thank you very much for attending, and let's give a thank Thank you to all the speakers.